Colossians 3, 16 through 21.
Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. And whatsoever ye do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by Him. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands, as is fit in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. This ends the reading of God's holy, inspired word. It's Lord's Day morning. We come again, after having missed a week, having skipped a week because of prayer meeting last week, we come again to consider parenting by the promises. And we come to the third section of four in this book by Dr. Beeke. In part one, or section one, we've looked at covenantal foundations for parenting, focusing mainly on the four different views of 1 Corinthians 7:14, where it says that a child of even one believing parent is in the covenant. And so we discussed that a child that's born of a believing parent or two believing parents is in an external covenant, which is breakable, but may or may not be in an internal covenant, which is unbreakable. And it's not until they come to faith that they are saved and then are in that covenant vitally with Christ, united with Christ savingly. Having talked about that principle for a number of weeks, we've been for a number of weeks considering parenting as prophets, priests, and kings. We saw that Adam and Eve, created in God's image, had roles to play in their family as prophet, priest, and kings. We see that Christ uniquely is the prophet, priest, and king, the fulfillment of those offices of the Old Testament church and of the Old Testament people of Israel. And now this week we come to begin to look at part three, which is practical steps for child rearing. Really just some, maybe not a full-orbed view, but some particular issues dealt with, teaching our children piety, how to listen, how to tame their tongues, and how to handle relationships with one another. But before Dr. Beeke gets into those subjects, he has a chapter here dealing with help from our Puritan forebearers, or what he calls forebears. So let me cover just a little bit of this chapter, and then we'll discuss some of the discussion questions. In the beginning of the section, kind of as he introduces the book, he quotes the form for the confirmation of marriage, and he says that in the Dutch form for marriage, the minister reads these words, since God made unto Adam his wife, brought and gave her himself to be his wife, witnessing thereby that he doth yet as with his hand bring unto every man his wife. And so what they're saying there is that in Genesis chapter 2, as God brings Eve to Adam, it's a picture not only uniquely of God giving Eve to Adam, but it's also a picture of God giving every wife to every man. It reminded me of Proverbs 19:14, where we read, a prudent wife is from the Lord. So clearly, spouses are gifts of God. He then moves to discuss children being gifts of God. It reminded me of Psalm 127:3. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is His reward. And then he kind of sums that section up at the very last paragraph of that section on page 171, where he says, the Puritans viewed child rearing as a responsibility larger in scope than the interest of their own families. They viewed families as nurseries for church and society. Puritan parents thus did everything possible to make sure their children conformed to biblical norms and precepts so that they would be well trained, educated, self-disciplined, cultured, and godly citizens of the commonwealth and stalwart members of Christ's church. You see, that's really somewhat different, I think, than many in what I call the family integrated movement today, or the patriarchal movement that's pretty popular amongst homeschooling Christian schoolers. In much of that movement, it's not just family integration, but it's family centeredness. And see, the Puritan view was they were called to be God-centered, saw three unique institutions that God had established: the family, the church, and the state. They recognized the family to be chronologically the first institution, but they also saw it as the building block for the other two institutions, that it wasn't the only institution to focus your attention upon if you're pursuing God and godliness. So I think that's helpful. I think he's trying to make that distinction. If you remember in the beginning of this book, Dr. Behnke says his book's going to be primarily positive. In other words, he's kind of alluding, I think, at some points when he makes some of these positive statements, but he rarely mentions who he's trying to speak in distinction from. And so I'm trying to add some of that just to give you a little sense of what's going on here. But I think he wants to make that clear because he does have a high view of the church, does have a high view of God instituting civil government. No matter how bad civil government is, God's instituted it. And we can never forget that God in his wisdom has instituted the civil magistrate for the good of his people and the good of society. Then he moves to the authority in the family. In this section, again, I think he's probably alluding to the patriarchal movement because he's trying desperately to show that women have a significant role in terms of authority in the family. Quotes from a number of Puritans. I think the one I'll mention is here, Samuel Torschel, at the bottom of page 172, he says, this is what he said: "Women may and must privately and familiarly exhort others. They may also privately admonish men and reprove them." Now here I think Dr. Behnke is moving into dealing with husband and wife relationship, which most of the book is focused on nurturing of children. I don't think in this section he does justice to Ephesians 6:4, fathers, nurture your children. Or here in Colossians 3:21, fathers, provoke not your children to anger. Those words are literally fathers, not parents. So there is something about the father's unique role in the family. But I think what Dr. Behnke here is doing again is dealing with what would be called hyper-headship, where the patriarchy movement sometimes views it as it's only dad's business, and as though he can't delegate through his wife, as though his wife's kind of out of the picture. And in hyper-patriarchy, basically women are treated like children. So the father nurtures his wife and his children. And that's not the biblical model. I think Dr. Behnke's here saying, no, you know, the father is the head, but his wife, they are one. And so she has to be involved in the child rearing in a significant way. And quite often, she's going to be the one that's on the ground nurturing the children day to day for many more hours than the father's going to be able to do. So, and you see that throughout the scriptures, I think, when you see Solomon encouraging his son relative to the teaching of his father and his mother. And if you see throughout the book of Kings, even when good or bad kings are mentioned, often the chronicler in Chronicles or in Kings says, "And his mother's name was." I think that's an indication that his character significantly was affected by his mother's nurture or lack thereof. Any comments about what we've covered thus far? Questions? Children as gifts, authority in the family, the right place of husband's wife. Yes, Ed. I think my understanding, as best as I understand it, and there are a lot of Orthodox Jews that they're in Philadelphia and kind of semi-Orthodox Jews that I grew up with. I think so, but I think they tend to lean towards, I would liken their view as a covenant successionist within their Presbyterian view. In other words, they have so connected the Old Testament blessings that were promised uniquely for God's people when they were a nation, when they were worshiping, when they were a nation in Israel in the Promised Land. They've so connected those, and then they've logically or illogically argued from effect to cause. And therefore, if I can make the effect look good, if I can make it look like I'm blessed, then I must be godly. Rather than God saying, I bless the godly, and sometimes it's external. Sometimes it's through external suffering, right? No, generally a little bit lower than evangelicals do. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I think that, and I think they tend towards works. Yeah. But I think Dr. Beakey is making this point that the Puritans understood that there's an inherent equality between men and women, and therefore women have a right to be admonishing and exhorting their husbands. I mean, when you read Samuel Torschel's comment, it almost sounds like they can privately admonish men. I don't think he's saying, he's encouraging women to go, you know, call up men and ask them to meet at Panera, you know, and lay it on them, you know, for what they did at fellowship meal or whatever. Yeah. But I think he is saying, you know, they are equal and have a right to admonish their husband. You know, and in public settings they may say, hey, that was a little short. Don't you think that was a little shorter? You know. But I think that's the point. And I think that's, you know, it kind of lets us know our children can reprove us too, right? I mean, and citizens can reprove magistrates, and, you know, members of the church can reprove their elders and their officers. So we have that. We need to understand that. We need to do it properly. But I think that's what he's suggesting. I think he's bringing that up because of what he sees in the evangelical culture. And can you understand some of the hyper-preterism? Not hyper-preterism, but hyper-patriarchalism as an overreaction to the culture that we're living in? Where, I mean, feminism is just dominating. It's dominating the church. It's dominating a lot of Reformed churches. I got a little sense of that at Christ Covenant, that men's meeting a couple weeks ago, where that became pretty evident that the minister and many of the elders understand that that is fairly rampant culturally in their congregation. There's an article I haven't read yet in the latest Table Talk that's dealing with divorce in the Reformed Church and how prevalent it's becoming. And the Reformed Church's numbers are starting to look a lot like the evangelicals' numbers, which are starting to look a lot like the world's numbers. And the contention, just as I just breezed through the article, seems to be it is related to feminism. The women are being sold a bill of goods, and then there's more clash, and then divorce is imminent. So, okay, let's move on to principles of child rearing. Dr. Beakey mentions seven that the Puritans are particularly helpful on. He says that they speak relative to the responsibilities during pregnancy. A number of the Puritans talk about how we should pray for our children in the womb, also that we should protect them in the womb. And many of them refer to Manoah and his wife and how the Lord guided them in terms of the rearing of Samson, even in the womb. Clearly, there's a lot of studies that suggest children in the womb can do hear things outside the womb. Their brain waves are affected by the kind of music played. and the music's not pumped into the womb, but from outside the mother, they can hear the beat and the like, and brainwave things change, and kids in the womb actually settle down when classical music or fairly sophisticated music is played. But when cacophony or rock or, you know, it disturbs the child's heart rate and brain waves and the like. So pretty interesting. That suggests that children can gain from family worship even in the womb. Mother's role, I think your notes say carrying. I think carrying. I changed in mine. Must have been as I was typing, it must have self-corrected. Mother's role in caring for newborns. Amazingly enough, the Puritans recommended breastfeeding. There was actually a breastfeeding, non-breastfeeding debate at the time. People with wealth could easily say, you know, they could afford having someone else take care of some of the menial tasks. That was viewed as a menial task for upper class people. They suggested, no, it really doesn't matter about class, whether you can afford it. There's a certain nurturing, there's a certain certain bonding, right, that takes place that ordinarily ought to take place if a woman can breastfeed. You know, why not? But they're emphasizing you need to care for your children physically, emotionally, spiritually, even as newborns. Then they focus on the covenant obligation for baptism. Christians should have their child baptized in recognition of the fact that they're in the external covenant. They also should educate their children in the ways of God. And I thought Richard Baxter's quote here was very helpful. He says at the bottom of page 74, "Let it be the principal part of your care and labor in all their education to make holiness appear to them the most necessary, honorable, gainful, pleasant, delightful, amiable state of life, and to keep them from apprehending it as needless, dishonorable, hurtful, or uncomfortable. Especially draw them to the love of holiness by representing it as lovely." I think he's focusing on example. And if we're pushing or cajoling our children to external godliness without demonstrating the love and delight in godliness in our own families, having an atmosphere of joy as well as reverence, we're going to lose our children. And then he quotes Richard Branham. So I found this quote very helpful. "Experience teaches us that children like or mislike more by countenance, gesture, and behavior than by any rule, doctrine, precept, or instruction whatsoever." What's he getting at? "Experience teaches us that children like or mislike more by countenance, gesture, and behavior than by any rule, doctrine, precept, or instruction whatsoever." I think what he's getting at is you can put a lot on a child, but if you do it gracefully, you do it for their good out of love that's demonstrated in your gesture, in your countenance, and how you speak to them, they will take it on and they will respect you and love you for it. But if you pile things on or don't, but have or mean, they pick up and they're not attracted to that, whether it's a parent or a teacher or what have you. I think that's true in the business world. I think I've seen work groups who are held to a very high standard by leaders who are graceful and calm and seek to build some camaraderie amongst the group. And those groups do far more than other groups, and they enjoy and they appreciate the fact that their leader's making them work harder than most of the other people in the firm. And yet there are others who drive their people to excel out of insecurity, often in their own lives, and their people despise them. And there may be a superficial level of high performance, but it's very shallow and
puts that kind of work group in jeopardy of falling apart at any moment. Does that make sense? Anybody have a comment or thought of it? I just want to make sure everybody's tracking. Jeff, you want to comment? Seems like you're shaking your head. Does it make sense? I think we all have a lot to learn there. Fifth, family worship. They emphasize family worship as a significant means of covenant nurture. They have a quote, I think it's just Dr. Beakey talking about singing on page 176. Singing can be a special means of instruction for our children. Even little children can sing, so they are never excluded from this method of teaching. They will not understand everything, but that is not the point. They can and should participate in singing as part of the worshiping family body. Singing must be biblical and doctrinally pure, which is why the Puritan songs of choice were the Psalms of the Bible. So he's careful there. Their denomination is in practice pretty much exclusive psalmody, but they do have a couple hymns that they can constitutionally sing, but they don't. But I think he's emphasizing the place of singing, not just in corporate worship, the Psalms, but in family worship. He's saying especially that's important for young children. They might not understand much of the reading, but if they're singing the Psalms over and over again with the family, they are memorizing those Psalms. And as they get older, those words are already in their heart, and they can begin to apply them to their lives. Then he refers to the need for chastening, as the sixth principle that the Puritans help us with, as well as seeking potential help in making life decisions, number seven. And the two that the Puritans thought were particularly important was relative to vocation and to spouse. He quotes Richard Adams relative to vocation, and then he summarizes the teaching of the Puritans with the bottom of page 177, and 178, five questions, he says, that we ought to be asking our older children who are young adults as they consider marriage. I thought that's as well very helpful. Any comments or thoughts on any of those principles? Anything that anybody found unusual or particularly helpful? Well, then Dr. Beakey closes the chapter with a section on what he calls an exercise in godliness. And I'll just quote him here at the bottom of page 179. He says, "The home was the backbone of the church and the commonwealth." That's what he'd already said earlier, the first quote I gave. "So the Puritans labored hard to make families into well-ordered miniature churches and domestic commonwealths. Families are the nurseries for church and commonwealth. Ruin families and ruin all," said Increase Mather, one of the New England Puritans. Ruin families and ruin all. And we see that happening before our very eyes in our culture. Children coming to adulthood, not being reared in the fear of God, not being reared with a certain understanding of biblical loving authority exercised in the home. And they're ill-prepared for the work world, living in the community, or living in a community of the church. Let me ask a few of the questions, and we've got, I mentioned four of them, or we'll look at four of them. The first one is, how did the Puritans view child rearing? What can we learn from their view of the family as the backbone of the church and commonwealth? Jeff?
Yeah. raising adult members of the church, adult members of the Commonwealth.
Right.
So they want, their goal is mature, well-adjusted, godly church members and members of the Commonwealth.
Good. Good. Yeah, I think particularly for the New England Puritans that he's quoting, they actually had a view of you needed citizenship, or you had to be a church member to be a citizen. So there was a very, very close connection, closer to the theocratic model, the Old Testament, rather than necessarily what was required in the New Testament. Harry? Right. Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's what the book has been saying all along. I think this chapter maybe doesn't emphasize that a whole lot, but I think that's what the book's been focusing on. So I think Dr. Beakey's kind of going to the other two sides. We could say that the goal of parenting is to be used as a means of grace to the salvation of our children. Right. But secondarily, we're also trying to produce God. Somebody can be saved and still not be a godly parent or a godly. It could be ill prepared. In other words, they could be converted but be ill prepared to be a good parent, to be a good citizen, or magistrate, or church member, or church officer. So their goal was beyond that, to see them then grow in that, and also to teach them all these principles so that even if they weren't converted, they'd still be a useful member of society. Right? I mean, the Westminster Confession teaches that it's good for people to do right things even if they're not converted. It's still better to follow the Ten Commandments. So I think you'd say first is their own conversion. You want to you want to encourage them relative to their relationship with God, right? One. Then you want to help produce a child that's serving the Lord and can serve the Lord as a good parent or spouse, and then church member and citizen in the Commonwealth. So I think they had a balanced view. They did see the family as significant. And I think we live in a day and age which is post that, where evangelicalism and even reformed churches for years have kind of pushed that work off to somebody else. That's the church's job. It's not our, or it's the state's job. Let the state raise our children in public school, or maybe in evangelicalism, let the Christian school or let the church elders, let them take, we'll send the kids to Christian school or we'll send them to Christian education, Sunday school, we'll send them to Bible school or whatever, and then we've done our duty. But what they're saying is family worship is integral, and not that the state and the fathers and the church don't have some role to play, but they are not the primary nurturers of our children. We are. Question four is, what can we learn from the Puritan style of family worship? Who wants to give a stab at what was in Puritan family worship, what they believe belonged in there, as the directory of family worship states? Anybody want to take a stab at it, or do you want? Jeff? Right. Right.
There's going to be singing the songs.
Right.
There's going to be some sort of
Right, particular issues. Right. Good. And I think it covers it. Prayer, reading, singing, discussing the reading, and potentially discussing things that have happened in God's providence and the biblical principles that deal with that, even if those principles aren't found in the passage you just read. Wherever they're found in the Scriptures, discussing those. Sometimes those can be discussed right as they happen, but sometimes they really need to kind of regroup and take time as a family and all think about how should we handle that? How did that go? Or what should we do in this situation? Good. And so what can we learn from their style of worship? Right, good. Make it relevant. Yeah, I think it takes a lot of work. I think that's probably part of what Dr. Beakey's trying to get as an exercise in godliness, that to actually carry this off as a father and a mother, in a delegated fashion, requires a lot of piety on our own part. And it is also an exercise in godliness to actually continue to carry it on, desiring to be more relevant tomorrow than we were today, and keep going, even though we know we aren't as relevant as we'd like to be. We know sometimes our children think we're dinosaurs. The reality of that, you're doing something good, but you're inadequate. And yet you keep, by God's grace, doing what you can and asking God to bless it. That certainly involves a lot of godliness and patience. See that throughout the book of Revelation, the testimony of the Lord Jesus Christ, the keeping of His commandments, and the patience of the saints. In other words, we don't get everything that we have coming to us immediately. We have to believe and hope in the promises of God. Good. How about 6? What can we learn from Puritan parents' involvement with the major life decisions of their children throughout their teen years and as young adults? What role do you think you should play today in helping your children decide what career to pursue or whom to marry? Let's get it started. Somebody give me some thoughts about that. And would you acknowledge that maybe in a world where people had been farming with the same tools for thousands of years prior to the Industrial Revolution, that children weren't as tempted to think they knew something more than mom and dad? But nowadays, the technology changes so fast, and if a kid has some piece of technology that you don't have, in a day or two, they think they know how to operate something that's really important, and you don't. And they're really on the top, they're on the cutting edge of. And so I think that kind of thing in our culture is as well as the erosion of authority in any family, any structure, leads the youth to think they know better than the age. So, good point. Yeah, it's built on the fact that they thought their parents knew something. And obviously, I guess that comes from our parents actually, we as parents actually demonstrating that we do know something and and doing it without meanness and curtness and coldness so that our children, the lines of communication are open with our children. So they want to hear what we have to say. They value what we say, and they're interested in the relationship they have with us. Any other thoughts about the Puritan view and how we can... Is it biblical? Is it a biblical view? What do you think?
At this point, I guess I can ask a question to my children.
Well, it's kind of hard. Right. Well, I think what you have to realize is the English Puritans were wanting reform from the Church of England, and they did want not only worship reform, but they did, most of them, come to understand Presbyterianism. So when the Westminster Assembly went on, there were only less than two handfuls of Scots there, and yet the majority of those men wanted Presbyterian church government. No, yes, so I'm saying most of them were still in the Church of England, and it's Episcopal. Okay, so it's a hierarchy, and so most of them are living in a hierarchy and living in liturgical worship, and they're wanting Presbyterian simple worship, and they're wanting Presbyterian government. And so the 150 men there, there are eight Scots, almost all the rest of them Englishmen. And they're not all there at one time. Okay, they're coming and going. There are only about 10 independents. So 120 of these guys had come to Presbyterian views. They just never saw it implemented in England. And so, therefore, they never really experienced it in England. But of those men that were there at Westminster, who we generally call the English Puritans, that's what they wanted. Though they never got it. Remember, they were eventually ejected from their pulpits, and then they weren't really able to form presbyteries because they weren't supported by the state, and had a hard time going on. So yes, a lot. But again, this view of parents having that role certainly is not in vogue in our society. Now, it certainly went out in the probably 60s significantly, and has been out of vogue for a long time. And then we do have a reformed hyper-reaction where, you know, there are dads that take to themselves become the sole evaluator of potential suitors, and don't engage their daughters in what their daughters think and know of the young gentleman, and also think they can absolutely refuse without any basis other than their opinion. And the Puritans didn't teach that. The Puritans actually taught that, you know, the session could get involved if parents seemed to be excessive in terms of their overly burdening. And they did believe in somewhat of a romantic love. There's no evidence that they believed that marriages were to be arranged ordinarily the way they are occasionally in the Old Testament. But there are hyper patriarchal people who try to suggest, you know, Abraham's example is the example that we should follow. That's not the only example in Scripture about how marriages take place. And that was somewhat extraordinary. You know, God directed His servant to that woman. You know, you can't take something like that and make it a norm for us who have to make those kind of evaluative judgments. So now we're trying to implement, I think, a biblical principle, but I think the reality is a lot have, and I think have overdone it. I had a good conversation with Mr. Fast on Monday as we went on that walk. His boys have been through some of that. You know, and they've run in circles what he would call hyper patriarchalism. So, that whole courtship and the like. I mean, there's a lot of books on courtship that have a lot of principles that don't have Scripture to support them, or twist Scripture to support some of the things that the men want to teach. But those are very popular, and in a homeschooling fad mentality, there's all kinds of people that will flock to those kind of conferences so men can give their own private opinions about matters, and people eat up their CDs and books and spend a lot of money. There's a lot of money to be made in all that kind of business. But I think they're hitting on some good principles, but sometimes not on a sound basis, sound footing.